The Creator's Prerogative, the 35th talk in a series on Romans, was presented by Jack Crabtree on November 7, 2010, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're in Romans chapter 9. If you are looking at my formatting, we're going to look at paragraph 84, and that's all I want to deal with today. Probably it won't take me a long time. I hope not. And I'll leave plenty of time for questions because I think this is a very discussion-worthy passage, paragraph. Let's get a running start. At 9:6, I'm going to start reading there in my translation. Now, it is not as if the promise of God has failed, for it is not the case that all those who are descended from Israel, these are Israel. Neither is it true that all his children are the seed of Abraham. Rather, in Isaac a seed for you shall be named. It is not the case that the children by physical descent, that these are the children from God. Rather, the children of the promise are accounted as the seed. This is the wording of the promise. At this time next year, I will come, and Sarah shall have a son. And not only this, but also Rebekah conceived by this promised one, by Isaac, our father, when they had not yet been born, before they had done anything good or evil, in order that the chosen purpose of God might continue, not resulting from their actions, but as consequence of the one who appoints, it was said to her, the older shall serve the younger. Just so it was written, Jacob I loved, and Esau I hated. So what are we saying? There is no unrighteousness with God, is there? Of course not. To Moses, he says, I will grant mercy to whomever I grant mercy, and I will show compassion on whomever I show compassion. So then, ultimately, it is not from the one who is choosing it, and it is not from the one who is running after it. Rather, it is ultimately from God, the one who grants mercy. With reference to Pharaoh, the scriptures say, for this very reason I raised you up, so that I might demonstrate my power through you, and so that my name might be proclaimed in all the land. So he shows mercy to whomever he wants, and he hardens whomever he wants. And here's the passage we'll look at eventually here today. You will say to me then, why then does he still find blame? For who has ever resisted his will? But to the contrary, who are you, O man, the one defending himself against God? The thing shaped will not say to the one shaping it, why did you make me like this, will it? Rather, does not the potter have a right with respect to the clay to create from the same lump that which will be a vessel for honor and that which will be for dishonor? Okay, briefly to review, going all the way back to the beginning of chapter 1, in the first paragraph, 1 through 5, he basically defends himself against the charge that was likely current in the time that Paul was traveling and preaching and proclaiming the gospel. The charge being made by the traditional Jews and Jewish culture is that Paul is teaching what he teaches against Moses, against the law, against their traditions, against the temple, against everything that makes Judaism Judaism. In other words, they're basically accusing him of being anti-Semitic, that he had a bad childhood as a Jew, and he's getting back at his father and all of the other influences in his life by reacting against it and rejecting it and inventing a new religion because he's so hostile to the religion of his youth. And Paul makes the case, he makes a plea. You see his heart. It's an incredible paragraph, an incredible window on the soul of Paul. He goes so far as to say, if I could be damned and they could be saved, if they could believe in Jesus and I could be damned, if I could trade places with them, I'd do it in a minute because it belongs to them. This is the promise to them. This is what they should embrace. This is what they should enjoy. This is the blessing that should be their blessing. And it would be so right and appropriate if they would reach out and lay hold of it. So if I could trade places with them, I would. because it would be very appropriate. He loves his heritage. He's proud of his heritage. He has no animosity toward his heritage whatsoever. Then he gets into the question, and the question is, but didn't God promise us, speaking for the Jews, but didn't God promise us Jews that we would be the people of blessing? Didn't he promise us a blessing? And here you are coming along, Paul, saying that if you don't believe in Jesus, you don't get the blessing of Abraham. You don't get the eternal life that God promised our father Abraham thousands of years before. So how can that be right, Paul? How can we, to whom the promise came, miss out on the very promise that he promised to us? The underlying assumption, as we explored, the underlying assumption is that by being a Jew, I, as an individual, have been promised by God that the blessing of Abraham will come to me. And we're going to see throughout this whole chapter that really, basically, he's coming at it from a couple of different directions. But in the final analysis, the bottom line is the promise that God made to Israel was to Israel as a people group, not to Jews as individuals. Where I stand as an individual Jew, whether I will be blessed or whether I will be condemned, that's a different question from whether God is going to be faithful to do a remarkable and dramatic thing within the people group of Israel. So Paul's going to work really hard to make clear, yes, God is going to be faithful to the Jews as a people group. There's no question about that. He will not forsake them. He will not bail on his promise. He will be faithful to keep that promise. But although he's going to be faithful to the people group of Israel, I as an individual Jew cannot automatically presume that that means I as an individual will get in on the blessing of Abraham. That's a different question. And so in what I call paragraph 81, verses 6 through 13, he makes a very simple but powerful argument. He says, Abraham had two children, Isaac and Ishmael. Isaac was the child of promise who inherited the promise of there being a people that comes from him. Ishmael did not inherit that promise. Isaac had two children, twins, and only one of them was the heir to the promise to Isaac. Jacob received the promise. Esau did not receive the promise. Now Jacob, renamed Israel, had 12 children. And Paul's basically raising the question, just because all of them were children of Israel, did that automatically make all of them heirs of the blessing of Abraham? We have to understand that being biologically descended from a father of promise doesn't necessarily make me as an individual a child of that promise. That's a different question. Yes, there is going to be in history God keeping his promise to a group of people that are going to identify as Israel. No question about that. But as an individual descended from Israel, there are other criteria that's going to decide what I as an individual receive and what I don't receive. And then he makes that crystal clear in the next paragraph. That's verse 14 and 15. That's what we looked at last week. So what are we saying? There is no unrighteousness with God, is there? Of course not. To Moses, he says, I will grant mercy to whomever I grant mercy, and I will show compassion to whomever I show compassion. And we looked at the context for that. When we see the context, we realize what a powerful argument that is. The context is surrounding the events on Mount Sinai, where Moses leads the people to Mount Sinai to meet God and to enter into this relationship where God will be their God and they will be his people, and God's going to make a covenant with them to define the terms of that relationship. What does it look like to be his people, and what will it look like for God to be your God? And the Mosaic Covenant defines that. But in that context, in the very midst of the negotiations, the people of Israel freak out, decide that God has eaten Moses or something, killed him, slayed him somehow, and make an Egyptian god to worship to lead them back out of the wilderness. And Yahweh, God, gets angry. And he tells Moses, I'll tell you what, how about if I wipe out the whole cotton-picking lot of them? Let me just destroy them and annihilate them, and I will start over with you, Moses. But Moses realizes that if God does that, that really violates the very purposes of God that God himself has articulated to the people of Israel and ultimately through them to the world. God said he was going to do one thing. If he changes his mind and does another thing, that's going to make God be fickle and unfaithful and not loyal to his own purposes. So Moses pleads with him. And if you really pay attention to the text, that pleading with God transpires over the course of days, weeks, maybe even months. It's hard to get a fix on what kind of time span we're talking about. But it wasn't a one-on-one momentary encounter. It was over the course of time where Israel is left wondering, will God destroy us or will God lead us into the promised land like he said he would? And they are waiting with bated breath, hoping that God will be merciful. And finally, Moses comes to Yahweh and says, what have you decided? What's the verdict here? And God says, okay, I will lead you into Canaan, and I will go with you. I will be faithful to my purposes and my promises. I will be your God, and they can be my people. But, I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion, and I will have mercy upon whom I will have mercy. The point that he's making is, I will keep my promises to the people group. The nation has my commitment. I am committed to preserving them as a people, blessing them as a people, and fulfilling all the promises that I've made to them as a people. But what I do with any single individual among them, that's my business. And I will show them mercy if I decide them to show them mercy, but I won't show them mercy if I decide not to show them mercy. Which then leads him to the next paragraph, that's 16 through 18, where he begins to extrapolate then philosophically, and what are the implications of that? So then, ultimately, is not from the one who is choosing it, and it is not from the one who is running after it. A suggestion came up in a discussion last week, maybe it's running away from it. That actually could be. I don't know how to take that. I'm assuming that it's positive, the one choosing it and pursuing it, I assume. But his point doesn't depend on that, because either way he's going to make the same point. It's God who's the one who determines it. So then ultimately is not from the one who is choosing it and not from the one who's running after it. Rather, it is ultimately from God, the one who grants mercy. So what is it that dictates how God deals with individuals, whether Jews or Gentiles? What is it that determines how God will deal with us? Well, on the one hand, we have plenty of evidence in the New Testament. It's the one who believes who will be saved. It's the one who follows Jesus who will be saved. It's the one who embraces the truth rather than denies the truth that will be saved. We have all kinds of evidence that the criteria is faith, or the criteria is what actually underlies faith, an openness, a receptivity, an orientation toward God that makes me want to embrace the purposes of God and the promises of God and the truth from God. That's ultimately the criteria that determines. But what the point Paul is making here is, while that is the criteria that gets played out in our lives that determines whether we will be blessed or not, it's not the ultimate basis for who gets saved. Because why are you receptive? Why are you so oriented toward God that you are willing to embrace his truth rather than reject it and deny it? Why do you believe rather than not believe? Well, ultimately, Paul says, it's because there's somebody bigger than you, beyond you, more transcendent than you, who has access to your heart. And your heart is going to be what God has decided it's going to be. If you're going to be hardened against the truth, then you will be hardened against the truth. If you are going to be receptive to the truth, then you will be receptive to the truth. That gets played out in real time by you. You resolve your will. You struggle. You fight. You have to decide inside, what do I want? Do I want to be an obedient servant of God, or do I want to go to my destruction as a rebel against God? You and only you can decide that. But thanks be to God, the author of all reality, the author of my very being, is ultimately in control of what I'm going to do. And I say thanks be to God, because if it were left up to us, who of us would ever resolve our will in the right direction? It's only because God is willing to have mercy upon us that any of us ever come to believe. It is so unnatural for us to believe. It is so unlike us to lay down our arms and soften our resistance to God. It is so natural to resist. So what Paul is saying here is that ultimately the God who is the author of our being, the creator of my very existence, he's the one who ultimately determines upon whom he will have mercy and upon whom he will not have mercy. And he gives the example of the Gentile Pharaoh. With reference to Pharaoh, the scriptures say, "For this very reason I raised you up, so that I might demonstrate my power through you, and so that my name might be proclaimed in all the land." God has purposes that he wants to accomplish. I mean, and this is a great example of what I think we have to grasp if we're going to grasp biblical Christianity. And that is the dramatic and narrative structure of reality, of human history, and of your own life. You are the center of a drama that centers in you and your life. God has a purpose for that narrative, that story that you are in the center of. The story that he's creating with your life is not ultimately about you. It's ultimately about the purposes of God. If we don't understand that, there is no way, I think, that we can have a coherent picture of biblical theology and biblical Christianity. What we're going to do instead is invent a new Christianity. So the fact that God has that kind of power and that kind of is that much in the ascendancy is foreign to most of our ways of thinking. I was on the phone with a guy in the Bible Belt who was talking about a friend of his reading The Shack. I don't know if you've read The Shack, but he read The Shack and he really loved The Shack. And as we got to talking about it, it became very apparent that to me that the reason The Shack is so popular in Christian culture is because The Shack is literature that originates out of a different religion than biblical Christianity. And I don't hesitate to say that. It's not the same God. It's not the same concept of God. That they are night and day. The God of the Bible is the author of all reality, as we're going to see here in a second, is the potter to we who are the clay. That is so alien, so foreign, so unattractive, so against everything that modern traditional Christianity wants God to be, that I don't hesitate to say it's a different Christianity, it's a different religion altogether. And I think the more we can come to understand that, the more fortified we will be to truly understand the Bible. When we try to integrate traditional Christianity with biblical Christianity, we get hopelessly confused and all wound up in a knot. And the reason we get wound up in a knot is because we're trying to make compatible two alien religions. And I think we just need to come to terms with that. The God of biblical Christianity can make Pharaoh a foil for his purposes. The God of biblical Christianity can raise a man up in order to literally smash him. And if we don't understand that, then we don't understand the God with whom we have to do. So with reference to Pharaoh, the scriptures say, "For this very reason I raised you up, so that I might demonstrate my power through you, and so that my name might be proclaimed in all the land." So he shows mercy to whomever he wants, and he hardens whomever he wants. That's the God that we're dealing with. He ultimately, as the author of all reality, is in control of which individuals are going to receive mercy and which individuals are going to be hardened. I talked to somebody last week who missed this. I think I said this, but in case I didn't or in case you didn't hear it, notice the difference here. He shows mercy to whom he wants to show mercy, and he hardens whom he hardens. Those are not natural poles to each other. You would expect it to be he shows mercy to whom he wants to show mercy and he condemns who he wants to condemn. But he doesn't say that. He says he shows mercy to whomever he wants to show mercy and he hardens whomever he wills. The reason is there are two poles that map onto one another. Those whom he shows mercy to have a heart that is soft, that is tender, that is open, that is receptive to God. Those whom he condemns are hardened against God. They always go together. And it's crucial that we understand that. As a kid, when I was confronting the doctrine of election, I just remember my response to it, because the mental picture you have is someone in this long line in eternity, St. Peter's at the gate, you know, running interference or checking the list or whatever, and you get up to the gate of heaven, and Peter says, you know, I'm in the line, I want to be with Jesus line, and I get up to the gate, and Peter says, oh, sorry, dude, your name's not on the list. You can't come in here. But I want to be in there. I love Jesus. I want to serve Jesus. I want him to be my king. Sorry, you're not on the list, man. And so what we picture, our mental image of it, is people who really are open and receptive and tender and subservient and wanting to be obedient, but who are just sort of arbitrarily excluded because they're not on some fool list somewhere. That's what we think. And that's not at all what Paul is saying. Paul is very clear, I think, that anyone who wants to enter the kingdom of God, it's theirs. If you want to be there, you can be there. If you want mercy from God, mercy is more than abundant to be supplied to you. No one will be shut out who wants to be there. Anyone who is shut out precisely because they are hardened. They have stiffened their neck in their rebellion against God, and they're basically daring God to condemn them because in their pride and in their arrogance and in their presumption, they think that it would be immoral to condemn me. That would be immoral because I am such a valuable being, valuable person or whatever. It's only that kind of hardness that is going to be smashed by the judgment and condemnation of God. So it's very important in understanding what Paul is saying here that we make sure we understand those always necessarily automatically go together. God's granting mercy always goes together with people who are receptive and is never denied to anyone who is open and receptive. And God's condemnation always and only goes to people who are hardened against him and in rebellion against him. Okay, then the obvious question gets raised in the next paragraph here. You will say to me then, why does he still find blame? And this is the philosophical question of the centuries. Why does he still find blame? For who has ever resisted his will? So the issue is, well, if what you're saying is true, Paul, if Paul, as the author of our being, can make me hardened against him or make me receptive to him, and he's the one who's determining whether I'm hardened or receptive, why is he blaming me? Because he made me the way I am. He made me a rebel if I'm a rebel, and he made me receptive if I'm receptive. But if he's the one that made me a rebel, why is he blaming me for becoming a rebel? Because he's the one that made me that. Very natural question that we all ask all the time and has been debated down through the centuries. That's what Paul's raising here. Paul responds, but to the contrary, who are you, O man, the one defending himself against God? If you have another translation, I think the translators are interpreting it differently than I am, and so they translate it slightly differently than I do. If I understand what the translators are doing, and I may not, but if I understand what the translators are doing, they think he's playing the part of a Catholic nun in parochial school or something. Shut up, kid. Don't ask embarrassing questions like that. And they make it sound like Paul is afraid of the question and is slapping them down for even raising it, because we all know that he's caught in the contradiction here and we don't want to expose his contradiction. So shut up, kid. Don't ask that question. I don't think that's at all what he's doing. He's not dismissing the question. Quite to the contrary, he's answering the question and answering it very, very compellingly. He's saying, to the contrary, who are you? He's asking them to reflect. Think about it for a second. Who exactly are you, O man, the one who would defend himself against God by saying, why does he still find blame with me for being a rebel if he's the one who created the rebellion? The one who's trying to defend his rebellion that way, you need to reflect on who are you exactly? And what he has in mind is, if you think about it, don't you realize you are a creature? Are you not a creature? Are you God's peer? Are you God's equal? Do you live on the same plane as God? Does God owe you something as a fellow being, inhabitor of his particular level of existence? Is that who you are? Or are you in fact a creature? And I think it becomes clear that his answer is, you're a creature, in the analogy that follows. The thing shaped will not say to the one shaping it, why did you make me like this, will it? A pot doesn't cry out from the potting wheel as the potter is molding it and shaping it. A little more to the right, you know, I don't like my shape. Would you fix me? Would you make me different than I am? And this is not, Paul is not being ridiculous here. It's a much more profound point than pots don't talk. You know, it's not that pots are inanimate that is the issue. It's the issue that they are creations. That's the issue. And it really doesn't make any difference whether it's an inanimate creation or an animate creation. It is still a creation. And that's the analogy, is the relationship between creator and creation. The creation has no business, has no right, has no authority, has no standing, has no place to be dictating to the creator how to be created. That is clearly the prerogative of a creator. It's the creator who has purposes that he wants to accomplish, and he sets out to accomplish those purposes by creating that which will accomplish and fulfill those purposes. So that's what a potter does. He makes pot for his Cheerios, he makes a pot for his milk, he makes a pot for his water, he makes a pot for this, and he makes a pot that's a toilet. And Jody accused me of all that potty talk last week, but the reason for that is because I think that's what Paul is talking about here. Rather, does not the potter have a right with respect to the clay to create from the same lump that which is a vessel for honor and that which will be a vessel for dishonor? And that's a euphemism, I believe, for a toilet. So he really is talking about a vessel for what he calls honorable use, or a toilet, a pot that's made to be a toilet. And that's the example that he's giving. And he's saying, what? A potter can't make from the same lump of clay a pot to serve the purposes of functioning as his toilet, and then take from the same lump a pot that is made for the purpose of functioning in some other more honorable capacity? And perhaps the most honorable of all is to simply be a work of art that has no other function other than to just be dazzlingly beautiful and attractive and interesting. Does the potter not have the right to do that? Okay, then he's done. That's all he has to say. So let me try to flesh out how I think this answers the philosophical question. Let me make sure I've covered everything. Yeah. So how does that answer his question? Why does God still find fault? Well, the analogy is really quite simple and quite straightforward. A potter makes a pot, and then he uses the pot, or if you will, responds to the pot in a way that's exactly consonant with what it was created for and what it is. That is, if the pot is a toilet, then it is more than appropriate to use it as a toilet. If it is something else, storage for water, then it's appropriate to use it as a pot to store water in. By analogy, Paul's saying, what if God, as the creator, who has these purposes that he wants to accomplish in this dramatic narrative reality that is our lives and our existence, and he has a need for a rebel against himself, and he has a need for obedient, subservient creatures. If God needs them in order to accomplish his purposes, then isn't it appropriate for him to respond to them according to what they are? If he created a rebel, should he not respond to the rebel as if it weren't a rebel? Should he respond to it as if it weren't a rebel? If he creates a rebel, shouldn't he treat a rebel as a rebel? Just as the potter treats a toilet as a toilet, don't you treat a rebel as a rebel? Or if it's a human being who is open and receptive and contrite, isn't it appropriate for God to respond to the human being whose heart is contrite as if he were a human being with a contrite heart? Isn't there a morally appropriate response to a rebel and a morally appropriate response to someone who is contrite? And if he reversed those, if he rewarded the rebel and punished the one who's contrite, wouldn't that be a morally odd universe? And a morally odd God, right? So what Paul is saying is, we are what we are. Yes, we are what we are because God made us this way. But regardless of how we got to be what we are what we are. Rebel, or what's the opposite of a rebel? I need a good word there. Subject, okay. A rebel or a good subject. And so why does God still find blame? Well, dude, you're a rebel. I mean, that's what Paul is saying is, he finds blame because that's the morally appropriate response to somebody who's blameworthy. And a rebel before his creator is blameworthy. So that's why he still finds blame. Now, do you see where we get all mixed up is that we confuse God making a response to who I am. We confuse that with responding to why I am. And we say, in answer to the question, why am I a rebel? We say, well, it's God's fault. God made me this way. And that's true. That's what Paul is saying. God made you that way. It's God's fault that you became a rebel. But God doesn't punish us because we made the choice to be a rebel. God punishes us because we are a rebel. He is simply offering the morally appropriate response to what I in fact am, a rebel against God. That's the crucial piece to see. We won't follow his argument unless we understand that. I'll say it again. God is not blaming me because I chose to be a rebel against him. I made rebellious choices, but that's different. Making rebellious choices is different from choosing to be a rebel. None of us ever chose to be a rebel, ultimately. The author of my existence chose that I would be a rebel. But God is not blaming me for the fact that I became a rebel, as if I freely chose to be that. He's blaming me because I am a rebel. See, back to the potter. The potter doesn't treat the toilet as a toilet because it chose to be a toilet. It didn't choose to be a toilet. It had no say in the matter. Why does the potter treat a toilet as a toilet? Because it's a toilet. Because that's what it is. And so he treats it in a manner appropriate to what it is. Why does God condemn rebels against himself? Because he's treating the rebel against himself in the way that's exactly morally appropriate to what and who he is. That's his argument. Let me change the metaphor for a second and see if this helps at all. If I'm a house painter and I take a gallon of paint and I try to get the color I want and I really mess up. In fact, I mess up so bad that there's no amount of dye that I can add to it to fix it. So I decide I'm going to have to throw the whole gallon of paint out and start over. Can the gallon of paint say, hey, wait a minute, dude, I didn't make myself this color. You made me this color. Don't blame me because I'm not the right color, because I'm not responsible for me being this color. You're the one that's responsible, so don't blame me. Isn't the painter going to say, I'm not blaming you. You're just the wrong color. I don't want you on my house. I'm not blaming you for being the wrong color, but I'm making a decision that you're not what I want. And because you're not what I want, I'm going to throw you out. I'm not going to use you on the house. By the same token, if I were to cry out to God, why are you condemning me? I didn't make myself a rebel. You're the author of my being. You made me a rebel. I think God's response would be, I'm not punishing you because you chose to be a rebel. I just don't want rebels in my kingdom. And furthermore, rebellion is a moral issue. And because it's a moral issue, I need to respond to you in a morally appropriate way. And the morally appropriate way is to condemn and judge rebellion against the Creator. It may seem to us like there's no analogy between the paint or the pot, the paint and the painter, the pot and the potter. And the reason is because what God is doing is punitive, right? God is being punitive against moral rebels, disobedient creatures. He's being punitive. And the potter is not being punitive against the pot that he made a toilet. The painter is not being punitive to the paint that is the wrong color. That's true. They're not being punitive. Over here, God is being punitive, and that's where we go, yeah, it's one thing to discard people you don't want, but you're being punitive, God. Why are you being punitive? I think some commentators think Paul has missed the whole point because of the difference between those two, the pot and the potter versus the judgment of a human being with a free will. But he's not. His analogy is perfectly apt. Yes, God is being punitive, but that's because that's the appropriate response to a free moral agent who freely chooses to rebel against his creator. That's to be punitive is the right kind of response, just as using a toilet as a toilet is the right kind of response to a toilet. Being punitive toward a rebel against God is the right kind of response to someone who has exhibited and manifest their rebelliousness to the Creator. So it is the analogy is apt. It's perfectly appropriate. Any of you who have read my book know that I prefer yet another analogy, and the reason I prefer this is because it takes into account what it means to be a free moral agent and how the creator of a free moral agent would interact with a free moral agent. And the analogy I use is the author of a novel in relationship to the characters in a novel. As the author of a novel, I may in fact create characters who are utterly and completely evil characters. And what will I have transpire in the story of that novel with respect to those characters? If I believe in goodness, I'm going to have them ultimately meet their demise and be destroyed and be condemned, be punished for their evil. It would be a very weird novel where I rewarded good and punished. It might be weird. Where I rewarded evil and punished good. That would be morally confused to do that. But the characters that I'm creating are just like you and me in relationship to God. They have a free will. They do what they do out of their freedom. They do what they do without being made to do it by the physical laws of that universe. They're not running on instinct. They're not running on some kind of natural determinism where their genes made them do it or their body chemistry made them do it. No, they're resolving their will in their freedom, just like we recognize that we do. My characters are doing that as well. And yet, I don't hesitate, even though I authored every free choice they made in the story, I don't hesitate within the story to hold them accountable for the very free choices that they've made. If they have made themselves evil by the choices that they have made, then they should be held accountable and blamed for who they are. They are evil, so they should be treated as evil. I think Paul's analogy using the pot and the potter is perfectly adequate for the point that he wants to make. I mean, it makes the point quite aptly. I prefer the author and the character analogy because it makes another point clear that Paul's analogy doesn't make clear. Namely, it explains how God can both determine everything and yet I can be free at the same time. We experience our life as utterly and completely self-determining and self-creating as I, in my freedom, decide, am I going to obey? Am I going to disobey? Am I going to submit to God? Am I going to rebel against God? I'm the one that decides that. You don't decide it for me. You can't decide it for me. My body chemistry doesn't decide it for me. My childhood experiences don't decide it for me. We all know at each juncture along the way, I had a choice to make, and I chose what I chose in my freedom. We all know our freedom all too well. And there's nothing in Paul that in any way negates that, cancels that out, or erases that. He believes in freedom as much as you and I do. He appeals to it all the time in his letters. And yet, he's the same one who's saying we're kind of like pots who are made by a potter. Ultimately, every aspect of my being is shaped and molded by my creator. And what does that? That includes how I resolve my will and my freedom. I resolve my will and my freedom exactly as the author of my being, the maker, the potter, decides to do that. But it's hard because a pot is inanimate, it's harder to see that right on the surface. That's why the novelist and the character thing is so useful to me, because you can see that right on the surface of the analogy. When I create a character, I create a character who's making up his own mind. I mean, if you as a reader don't read it as the character making up his own mind, it's going to be a very uninteresting story to you. You have to realize that in his freedom, he's deliberating, he's agonizing, he's trying to decide, he's faced with that existential choice. What will I do? What will I be? What will I become as I face into this decision before me, this existential crisis? We read those novels with interest because they're deciding the same things we have to decide in life. Their experience is my experience. So unlike a pot, the existential freedom of the creation is worn right there on the surface of what it is I've created when I write a novel, when I create a character in a novel. So that's why I prefer that analogy. Why didn't Paul use that analogy then? Well, I don't think, I'm convinced that he would not reject it, that he would embrace that analogy. I mean, obviously, I think that. Why didn't he use it? Because I don't think it was available to him. Novels, as we think of novels, literature, as we think of literature, fiction, as we think of fiction, is a relatively modern invention. It didn't exist in the ancient world. You had myths, that's true. You had myths that were fictional. You had fictional stories. But they weren't, there wasn't this direct correspondence between an individual author and the myth. The myth belonged to the community. We don't even know who the author was. And so in the ancient world, I don't think you would have thought of a fictional account or a myth as somehow being authored. You wouldn't know what to do with that. because the authors were probably multiple. It evolved over time. It changed over time, and you don't even know who had input into it. But we know that a modern novelist sits down and in the quietness of their own imagination creates a whole story, a whole world, a whole set of characters. And we know that every one of the characters that that novelist creates lives and moves and has his being in the mind and imagination of the author of that story. Well, that's exactly the language that Paul uses in Acts. He quotes Euripides, God in whom we live and move and have our being. And I think that's exactly Paul's perspective. So I don't think he would hesitate to embrace this analogy. It's just that it was not available to him and his readers as a really active metaphor or analogy to use. Furthermore, I mean, that's not unprecedented. You could ask the same question when Paul talks about the body of Christ and the gifts that we all have. I mean, I can't help but wonder when I read that, Paul, football teams. There was your analogy, football teams. But he goes to the body, which to us, I think, probably kind of strikes us as an odd kind of analogy. But again, in Paul's time, team sports had really not been invented. You had teamwork within military warfare, perhaps. But as athletic competition, I don't even think there was such a thing as team sports back in his day. So the metaphor of a team is not really available to him yet. So he works with what is available, the body, the different members of the body. But if he were writing today, I mean, if he were watching the Ducks, he would definitely go to the team as the metaphor for who it is that we that brings unity to who we are. We are not the body of Christ. We are Team Christ, Team Jesus. Yeah. And I think there's a further reason that he goes to the potter and the potter, and that is because not only was it readily available to him, but Isaiah uses it two or three times. And I think he's just simply being biblical. Let me read these passages out of Isaiah real quickly. I can find them. In Isaiah 29, it says, "Woe to those who deeply hide their plans from Yahweh and whose deeds are done in a dark place. And they say, 'Who sees us or who knows us?' You turn things around. Shall the potter be considered as equal with the clay? That what is made would say to its maker, 'He did not make me,' or what is formed say to him who formed it, 'He has no understanding?'" The point that he's making is, really, if you stop to realize who you are as human beings, that you're just like clay in the hands of a potter, do you really think he doesn't know every iota of everything that you think and everything that you feel and everything that you choose? I mean, are you hidden from God? Seriously? Can you think that if you understand who you really are? In Isaiah 6, so notice how parallel that is to the point that Paul's making. I mean, the point that he's making there is how transcendent the potter is to the pot, how completely other and living and dwelling on a completely different dimension than the clay does, and on such a different dimension that he has access, knowledge of everything about the pot. There is nothing that he doesn't know. Likewise, there is nothing about us that God doesn't know. We think we can hide from him. We think he doesn't see us. Isaiah is saying, you got to be kidding. You don't understand who God is then, and you don't understand who you are in relation to God. In Isaiah 64, you meet him who rejoices in doing righteousness, who remembers you in your ways. Behold, you were angry, for we sinned. We continued in them a long time. And shall we be saved? For all of us have become like one who is unclean, and all our righteous deeds are like a filthy garment, and all of us wither like a leaf, and our iniquities like the wind take us away. There is no one who calls on your name, who arouses himself to take hold of you, and you have hidden your face from us and have delivered us into the power of our iniquities. So he's describing here Israel coming out of probably coming out of Babylon at that point, as people who have shown themselves to be utterly unworthy of God because of the level of their iniquities. But now, O Yahweh, you are our Father, we are the clay, and you our potter, and all of us are the work of your hand. Do not be angry beyond measure, O Yahweh, nor remember iniquity forever. But look now, all of us are your people. Your holy cities have become a wilderness. Zion has become a wilderness. Jerusalem a desolation. Our holy and beautiful house, where our fathers praised you, has been burned by fire, and all our precious things have become a ruin. Will you restrain yourself at these things, O Yahweh? Will you keep silent and afflict us beyond measure? So the cry of Isaiah at this point is giving expression to is, we are unworthy, we are rebels against you, we have been disobedient to you, but you made some promises to us, God. All these things that you gave us and all the things that you supplied for us, are you going to forget us? Are you going to forsake us? Or are you going to remember? And right in the middle of that, in the center of that is, why... Who is God? Who is Yahweh our Father? Well, we are the clay, and you are potter, and all of us are the work of your hand. Why is that significant? We can start off rebels, but is it beyond the ability of God to mold us and shape us into sanctified, open, receptive people to God? All God has to do is say the word, and light will shine in the darkness of our hearts. All he has to do is say, I want there to be light, and there will be light. That he's the creator of my very being. So the history, the generation after generation of rebellion against God, what Isaiah is saying, that ain't no obstacle to you, God. So are you going to remember us? And are you going to remember what you've promised us and remember what our destiny is? We are just clay. And you are the potter. We are clay in your hands. Do with us what you will. But I hope when you do with us what you will, that you will remember the destiny that you promised us. But again, the metaphor of the clay and the potter. And then I won't read all of this. Let's see. Well, thus says Yahweh. This is now he's talking about Cyrus, the king, emperor of Persia, when they had conquered the Babylonians. Thus says Yahweh to Cyrus, his anointed, his Mashiach, his Messiah, whom I have taken by the right hand to subdue nations before him and to loose the loins of kings, to open doors before him so that gates will not be shut. I will go before you and make the rough places smooth. I will shatter the doors of bronze and cut through their iron bars. I will give you the treasures of darkness and hidden wealth of secret places so that you may know that it is I, Yahweh, the God of Israel, who calls you by your name for the sake of Jacob, my servant. And Israel, my chosen one, I have also called you by your name. I have given you a title of honor, though you have not known me. I am Yahweh, and there is no other. Besides me, there is no God. I will gird you, though you have not known me, that men may know from the rising to the setting of the sun that there is no one besides me. I am Yahweh, and there is no other. The one forming light and creating darkness, causing well-being and creating calamity, or literally creating good and creating evil. I am Yahweh who does all these. Drip down, O heavens, from above, and let the clouds pour down righteousness. Let the earth open up and salvation bear fruit, and righteousness spring up with it. I, Yahweh, have created it. Woe to the one who quarrels with his maker, an earthenware vessel among the vessels of earth. Will the clay say to the potter, what are you doing? Or the thing you are making say, he has no hands? Woe to him who says to a father, what are you begetting? Or to a woman, to what are you giving birth? Thus says Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel and his Maker, ask me about the things to come concerning my sons, and you shall commit to me the work of my hands. It is I who made the earth and created man upon it. I stretched out the heavens with my hands, and I ordained all their host. I have aroused him in righteousness, and I will make all his ways smooth. He will build my city and will let my exiles go free without any payment or reward, says Yahweh of hosts. I'm not sure I understand that passage. It's not at all completely clear to me. But it seems that he's describing the natural rebellious state of man there in the middle of it. Man is perpetually striving with his maker. And that's why righteousness needs to shower down from heaven, because man left to himself is lacking righteousness. So the example of the pot in relationship to the potter, I think, is to illustrate and dramatize the absurdity of human rebellion against God. That's what he's trying to do. How absurd it is that we rebel against God. We have no standpoint from which to question what God has done in creating me, and we are in serious denial if we refuse to acknowledge the divine prerogative to mold and shape us as if God had no hands. That is, I think the idea of he has no hands is he has no right, he has no business shaping me and molding me as if he were not capable of shaping me and molding me. No, that's exactly who God is. That's exactly what his prerogative is. That's exactly what his power involves for him. Okay, so all that's to say, those are three places, and that's only three that I found without looking very deeply. There might even be more. But I think the reason he uses the pot and the potter analogy is that would have been well known from Isaiah in particular and the Old Testament scriptures in general. So it was readily available to him. Okay, we have a little bit of time. Let me stop there and entertain any questions you have.
Thank you very much, Jack. Would you say when you were talking about people are responsive to the mercy of God, whose hearts are soft toward them, and people get judgment whose hearts are hardened. Would another way of saying that be, in a sense, that every human being gets what he or she truly wants with regards to salvation or not salvation?
Yes. I hesitate a little bit there because in our rebellion against God, I'm not sure that we want destruction or condemnation. But what we want is to not allow God to have that kind of say over our lives.
Right. Yeah. I didn't mean to imply that we would want judgment, but rather, if we want to submit ourselves to God, we will get that mercy, and if we don't want to submit ourselves to God, we won't, because we don't want that. That's what I meant to ask.
Yeah, exactly.
So when it comes to the free moral agent, there's probably multiple ways to think about the idea of free, but a couple of them that crossed my mind, I wonder if you could comment about this. One might be free as in autonomous, and by that I mean uninfluenced by anything outside oneself. And another might be free as in deciding as far as one is aware of free as in, well, as far as the person knows, making the choice.
Help me with that last one. What do you mean by as far as a person knows making the choice?
Yeah, I need a lot of help with that. I had it in my head when you were talking. Let's see. Well, I think it goes back to what I was saying at first, getting what we want, making the choice that we want to make.
Oh, okay.
So in that sense, we're free. We perceive that we are free. We are choosing what we, as far as we know, want to choose.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure I'd even qualify it with as far as we know. I mean, we just are choosing what we want. I would say that that's the case. I'm afraid, I mean, forgive me if I get too philosophical. I mean, I've spent a lifetime pondering this issue, so I may be comfortable with vocabulary and ideas that you're not, and so it may be difficult to follow me. I don't know. But Jonathan Edwards wrote a book called Freedom of the Will. And it's generally, I mean, it has a lot of good things about it, but I fundamentally disagree with it. What Edwards was arguing is that my will always chooses what it wants. Whatever I am inclined toward, that's what I choose. And then he defines freedom as having the freedom to choose what you want. Then he goes so far as to say, but I'm not free of God in that. I'm certainly not free of God, because what God does is he creates my desires and my inclinations that in turn then incline my will to what it chooses. The problem with that is he puts an intermediary between God and my choice, namely my desires, my inclinations, if you're with me. So God causes my inclinations cause my will to choose what it chooses. The problem is, I think that's a fatal mistake philosophically, because if I'm only doing what my inclinations make me do, how am I different than an animal? How am I different than a grizzly bear or a penguin or a slug? I mean, I'm just doing what my instincts, what my biology, what my emotional map is setting me up to choose. Well, all of my moral instincts rebel at that I can't be held accountable if my choice is dictated to me by my instincts and my desires. So I'm rather inclined to think that what makes me a human being is I could have desires blowing with hurricane force through my being, and every fiber of my body and every cell in my body is saying, lie. And I can go, but that would be wrong. And I can actually give all the weight in the world to the still quiet voice that says that would be wrong, therefore I can't do it, and say no to the hurricane force of all of my desires and inclinations and so on and so forth. I think that's what it means for us human beings to be free. And I think we've experienced that. I mean, hopefully you've experienced that. And that's what makes me accountable in the way that animals are not. The grizzly bear eats the camper because everything in it, every cell of his grizzly bear body wants to eat a camper. And he doesn't even think in terms of saying no to that. I mean, why would you do that? But we human beings, being moral creatures, we're in a position to decide that what's morally right to do always trumps what I want to do, no matter how powerfully the wants are raging within me. So instead, I'm inclined to think there's no intermediary between God and my will. When I resolve my will, why do I resolve my will that way? Because sort of mysteriously, magically, transcendently, God creates in me the will to do this rather than this, the will to listen to morality and to say no to all the raging desires within me. So did that even come anywhere near addressing your question?
No, it's helpful. Thank you.
Okay.
Hey, Jack.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. So correct me if I'm wrong, but what I understand you characterizing Paul's use of the analogy of the pottery and the clay and its similarity to the situation that we're in with God and ourselves is that in the same way that the potter responds appropriately to the pot that he creates for one use and responds appropriately to the pot that he's created for another use, in the same way God will respond appropriately to a rebel and will respond appropriately to one who is subject to him.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed like in the section that you read from, was it Isaiah?
Mm-hmm.
That the point with Cyrus is that God is saying, you, Cyrus, are what you are because you fulfill an intention that I have. I intended to make you to serve a purpose with respect to what I intend to do with Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that that is a different point. Maybe I'm not understanding correctly, but that point of backing up a step and looking at the intentions maps really well onto the potter and the clay and God and his creation, that in the same way that the potter, out of his intention, intends to create a pot to use for this thing and intends to create a vessel to use for this thing, in the same way, we don't really get to complain because God, we are playing a role that God intends for us. God intended to create you to demonstrate his wrath and his justice and his power, and God intended to make you to show his mercy and his love. And so maybe you could elaborate on that.
So help me. So what's the difference between that and what I said as you?
That it seems to, in the same way that the Isaiah passage is focusing on the righteousness of God as God doing what he can do because he intends to do it, that the focus is more on the intention of the one who is creating or crafting and less on simply the synonymity in the way that one responds.
Sorry, the what?
And less on the appropriateness of the way one responds to something, you know?
Okay. Well, it might have been confusing for me to read that whole passage because, like I say, I'm not sure I understand that prophecy. There's a lot I don't understand about it. But I don't think the part about the clay in the pot really has anything to do with Cyrus. I don't think what he's saying is, I had the right to make you what I made you. I mean, in that case, in contrast to Pharaoh, what he's saying about Cyrus is, I raised you up in order to deliver my people Israel and go back and rebuild their temple and reestablish them in the land, and I've raised you up for that purpose. So that's a good purpose. His purpose for Cyrus is not judgment. His purpose for Cyrus is to play a role in the redemption of his people. But that really doesn't, I don't think, if I'm reading it rightly, is not why he brings up the analogy of the potter and the clay. It's been a while since I looked at it now. But I think that's in a different section of that prophecy where what he's dealing with is what? It's right after the thing about he's calling for God to, for righteousness to shower down from heaven. And I think what he's talking about is the need for rebellious mankind to receive God's, what he calls righteousness, however we understand that, and for God to send that. And it's right immediately after that that he talks about the pot and the clay. And I think I decided that what he's trying to do is to illustrate and dramatize the absurdity of human beings who are naturally rebellious, the absurdity of their rebellion. And I don't think it really has anything to do with Cyrus there. But I don't really know what that chapter in Isaiah is all about, so I don't know what I'm talking about.
Okay, could you then maybe elaborate on where you think that there is a difference in saying that the heart of the matter is you as a pot don't get to complain because the potter is responding in a way that's commensurate with your function, with what you are,
mm-hmm.
versus you don't get to complain because the potter has the right to make you what he made you, and that was his intention, to make you the way he made you. So
give me those two choices again. What's the first one?
The first is, you don't get to complain because you are what you are, and the potter is simply acting in a way that is appropriate for what you are.
Okay.
Versus, you don't get to complain because the potter intended to make you for that purpose.
I got it. Yeah, I don't make a distinction between those two. They're both true in Paul's analogy, and they're both true in our relationship with God. I am what I am because God has purposes that he wants to accomplish in and through my life. And he's made me to accomplish those purposes. And that's his prerogative as my creator. But that's what sets up the paragraph that we're talking about in Romans 8, where the question then is, well, why does he still find blame? And I think inherent within the same analogy is the answer to that question. Why does he still find blame? Well, because if God, in his purposes, purposed to make you a rebel and made you a rebel to accomplish his purposes, then it's only appropriate that he respond to you in a way that's morally and otherwise appropriate to a rebel, namely to judge you and find fault.
Okay.
So I think within the metaphor are the resources to see both of those things.
Hi. So I've asked you this before, kind of, and I have not read your book, but the problem that I always come up against is how does God's creation reflect the creator? Like, how can...
I'm sorry, one more.
How does God's creation reflect on the creator? How can God be perfectly good and yet create inherently sinful beings in his image? And I think in class I've even heard, creating man is God alienating a part of himself to interact with. And so it's just hard for me to understand the contradiction there.
Well, that's why I like the metaphor of the novel and the characters in the novel, because there, again, right on the surface, we can see that a novel... I mean, we have to ask ourselves the question, could Jesus, on the assumption that he was a morally perfect being, could I imagine Jesus writing a novel? He had better things to do, but in his spare time, writing a novel where characters in the novel did utterly ungodly, unrighteous, evil, cruel, horrendous things. My answer to that is, yeah, I can imagine that. Well, how could out of his goodness come that novel that contained all that evil in it? Well, because the creation of the novel ultimately really needs to be judged not on the basis of each paragraph and each page and each event that makes up the story, but the story as a whole. When you look at the story as a whole, what's the meaning and significance and message of that story? If it was evil, then the author's evil. But if the message and significance of the story as a whole was good, the fact that there were evil elements in it doesn't change the fact that that's a story that should have been told. It's a story that should have been written. It's a story that should exist. And it's a good, morally good author who brought that into existence. I think the same thing is true with God. Why does God create characters that are evil and things that are evil and events that are evil? He creates those things because he's not creating them in isolation. He's creating them as to be a part of a bunch of interlocking narratives and stories that makes up our reality. And when all is said and done, we need to get to the end, the last chapter of all these stories, and look back and then ask the question, should that have ever been brought into existence? And part of what it means for us to have faith is that we are anticipating. And this is important. We're anticipating. If we look at the world now, I don't know. How can I look at the incredible cruelty and evil and suffering in the world and go, boy, that's really great? I mean, all of us clutch at that, don't we? I mean, there would be something terribly wrong with us if my response, my empathetic response to the suffering in the world was, boy, I'm sure glad all that suffering exists out there. No, we really are troubled by it. But I have revelation. I have information that's been given to me in the Bible and in the life of Jesus and the revelation that we receive there that basically makes me confident that when we get to the very end of history, the very end of all these stories and look back, we'll look back and go, in spite of all the incredibly tragic elements in that story, that's a good story. It's a meaningful, significant message, and it should have come into existence. That's what we believe if our hope is in the God of the Bible.
Okay.
But it's I don't think any argument can ever be given, nor should it be given. I mean, there'd be, again, something wrong with me that can make me feel comfortable with the evil and suffering in the world. Mm-hmm. It should be discomforting. We shouldn't like it. But we can get to a place, I think, where we can believe, I don't know what's going on in reality, but I do believe I have come to know the author of reality. And because the author of reality is good, I can trust that somehow all that evil and suffering gets resolved into something ultimately good. That's my faith. That's my hope.
The deal about the pot seems to speak that if a pot is made to be a chamber pot, God wants you to be the best chamber pot you can be. Because why would he destroy it? Because, hey, good chamber pot, right? We have to make another one. So I understand that on that level. Whereas if you're a beautiful vase and that's what he made. But that to me is, that's the ultimate reality of accepting that he's a transcendent God, is that we're all subject to him. We are his creation. End of story. Whatever you're created as, you should be the best at whatever that happens to be without rebelling against him for being that. But then also, there seems to be this, does God create us and have every last little jot and tittle of all of our life laid out in those and directed exactly what we were going to do? Or did he just create a bunch of people with free will, and it could have been Frank Hitler rather than Adolf that did the things? In other words, he knew it was going to happen because he interjected this free will into man. And so he just knew things were going to happen, and he knew what was going to happen. But as opposed to him, so then he could hold us personally accountable because we misused our free will, as opposed to saying, I'm the pot God created. I accept him as my creator. I'm willing to accept a lot of life that I've been given, and God is my God. Or I can reject that and start sinning and doing my life, and God is not necessarily the author of each little action that I take, but yet he knew that if Dan gets created, Dan's going to do all this stuff. And therefore, even though he knew it, he's still going to hold me accountable because I'm making the choices along the line. He's mm-hmm. not actually directing that I'm making these choices. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the conflict that I'm seeing in this argument.
Okay. Well, two things. I don't think the analogy, I think given the way he's using the analogy, even though in a different context, what you're saying is absolutely right, that if God made me a chamber pot, I should be the best chamber pot that's possible. That's true, but I think that actually changes what Paul is arguing. Because the analogy for him is a chamber pot gets used dishonorably as a toilet, just as a rebel gets punished for being a rebel. And the analogy is, should a chamber pot object to being dealt with dishonorably? And he's saying, well, no. I mean, that's what he was made for. That's the appropriate thing to use him for. Should a rebel object to being condemned for being a rebel? Well, no. What's a righteous judge supposed to do except to judge rebellion against himself? And that's what he was made for, is to display the power and the justice of God. So do you see how that analogy is different than recognizing God's creator, being the creator of all of us, and therefore if we weren't in rebellion against him, we would submit to that and become the best of what he made us to be? That's a profound point, but it's a different point. But I think it's a profoundly true point. But do you see how it's different? Or maybe not, but we can talk about it. Then your other question is a great question, and that gets us into really, really deep philosophical waters, and I think we just need to painstakingly take a lot of time with that. My position, after years and years of thinking about this, my position is, just like in my analogy of the novelist and the characters in the novel, literally every thought is ultimately shaped and created and scripted by the author. If the character in a novel speaks, God made him speak exactly that. If a character in a novel thinks, God made him think exactly that. And I believe that's how much we are the creations of our Creator. Literally every detail and iota of my life is ultimately authored by God. So I don't think we have any independence or autonomy from God at all, such that God, you know, kind of turns me loose and then I end up doing what I do. I don't think that's the right picture. It's a plausible picture on the surface of it, but as you get into the deeper, difficult philosophical questions of it, I don't think it works in the end. In the end, I think you have to come to the position that I'm advocating.
I knew you were going
to say that. I got to let you go. Thank you.